Ever notice similarities in the worlds of horror and science fiction? Parallels in structure, worlds, character, or theme? Well, we notice this shit all the time. We refer to them as keys, and
Johnny has the keys.
Johnny has the keys, the podcast of horror and science fiction that shapes our lives, with your hosts, David Horton and Tim Smith, lifelong friends introduced and bound by their love of the genres. And now your hosts, Tim and David. Greetings, welcome, hello out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys. This is David.
And this is Tim.
And we want to say, hey, shout out to all you guys out there. Thanks so much for listening to us. Thanks for joining us. This is a podcast about science fiction, horror, films, television, literature, and all the things that affected our lives and how it works. Tim, how have you been?
I've been great, David. How have you been?
I've been good. What's anything been going on new? Do you have anything before I have something?
Well, actually, I was thinking what you said. It's a podcast about horror and sci-fi and maybe even having special episodes. You want to do a special episode?
Sure.
What would you like to do a special episode about?
Well, my thing is Stranger Things. Stranger Things just came out. I just saw an article yesterday that said this third season of this Netflix original series has already had 18 million people have binged it. Over 40 million people are watching it.
Wow.
Which is huge. It has become the most popular Netflix series ever. So it's topped, you know, I think Netflix begin with like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black
one.
And all those.
Yeah. Both of those were huge.
Yeah. And several seasons and blah, blah, blah. But this Stranger Things, the whole mythos and everything about it has just taken off and been crazy. And you've seen it, right?
I have.
Yeah. And I think it's such a great combo of, you know, of what this podcast is about. You know, it's horror and science fiction, you know, and we've picked several movies that we've reviewed that are both, but this just plays it so well and also has such a niche market that I don't think anyone's ever really captured as well.
Honestly, David, I think we kind of captured that niche market, and I think that this show not only represents both genres, but it kind of represents what we're doing. Because they loop in keys from all over the place that are exactly the kind of things we talk about all the time.
Totally. Know? And I love the fact that they just throw them out there or they expect you to find. It's kind of like they intentionally implanted Easter eggs, you know, all the way through all three seasons. But, a brief recap, step back. Just so for those of you listening, if you have not seen Stranger Things, seasons 1, 2, or 3 on Netflix.
Hang
go
up
right
now.
Yes. Stop listening. Go grab a bucket of popcorn and some new Coke and put on your best white athletic socks up to your knees and watch this show.
And your horrible shorts.
And your horrible
your
shorts.
Your horrible gym shorts, yes.
Because we will be spoiling it, so if you want to pause now and jump later to the episode that we're going to, you know, to The Exorcist, that's fine. But you know, just don't listen if you haven't seen it, because we will be spoiling and giving stuff away.
Yeah, you have been warned. We're going to talk about, you know, character deaths and everything. So tune out if you haven't seen it.
And this series is about a small Midwestern town somewhere, Hawkins, Illinois, I think, or Indiana.
Or Indiana. One of those two. I think it's Indiana. But
and done in a very 80s style all the way through. And it follows a group of children who encounter these paranormal or strange things, whether they're government-produced or paranormal or other dimensional, that kind of stuff. Basically, the story is that a government lab hidden in this town opens up a rift to another dimension. These kids, and it releases a creature that essentially abducts a boy in season one, and it's about all of his friends, you know, naturally manning their bicycles, trying to rescue him. And then it's gone through three seasons now of various complexity of these monsters attacking this town or this group of kids and their families and the permutations from it. What's your general take on it, Tim? What do you think? I mean, I love the fact that you just said that it reminds you of the podcast.
Oh, my God. It's like, you know, I didn't realize it because the show did come before the podcast. But in reflection, just listening to you talk about the different genres, I was like, you know, this show is like the literal embodiment of what we discuss about movies and how they relate mm-hmm. to each other. It just is all culminated into a fictional piece. So somewhat.
Yes.
If you want to go back to like first impressions, one of my gripes yeah. is when it first came on, everyone was saying, oh my God, it's like Steven Spielberg and Stephen King got married and did a television show. And I kind of feel it's more like Steven Spielberg and John Carpenter than I do Stephen King.
I agree. I totally agree. However, there were some Stephen King, you know, there's a lot of Stephen King in it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got the kids, which is very similar to like the Losers Club or the young boys from Stand By Me. But, yes. you know, Spielberg did that crap too with, you know, Goonies and Explorers and all that shit in the 80s.
E.T., all of that. Yeah. Yeah, the kids on their bikes thing was so. But every time I see kids on bikes, instead of thinking of Stephen King, I think of Robert McCammon and that one novel he had, A Boy's Life.
Boy's Life, yeah.
Yeah, which was like, I guess, his version of The Stand? No, that was another one. Anyway, he kind of has
his. It's been a long time since I read that, but it is sort of his homage to that coming of age novel, movie, whatever, you know.
Yeah, but seeing those, you know, and we grew up in that time, you know, even in the 70s when I was growing up, you know, the bicycle was your freedom as a teen, mm-hmm. you know, you could explore the world, and this was before there's a serial killer around every corner, so you know you could do it without your parents, you know, you only had to come back when the streetlights came on. Uh-huh. You know, that was the way it was. And this pays homage to all of that. I do think I was going to mention Stephen King. I had a couple of keys with him. The Duffer Brothers. This series is written and created by two brothers that are now just being known as the Duffer Brothers, which kind of reminded me of the Wachowskis. But they described the series as a coming-of-age horror story told as if we were telling it in the 1980s. So, in other words, they feel like they're making the movie with the aesthetics of the 1980s, which is cool. And uh-huh. and so works so well in the whole thing. But the Stephen King thing, sorry, I digress. The Stephen King thing was they couldn't come up with a title when they pitched it. You know, and it's the typical story. They had this idea. They come up with a 20-page pitch book. They go to every single cable outlet and network, and everybody turns them down. Because they say, we don't want such a story about a bunch of kids. Oh, it sounds like a children's story. Just take it to children's television. You know, whatever.
Kids are so hard to work with. Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah. Yeah, yeah, whatever. until finally Sean Levy had heard about it, read it, and said that he would work with it on them. And he's really the third partner in this, I have to say. I think Sean Levy is very important to the success of this series. I've seen him in a bunch of interviews, either from like Comic-Con or other things, and his insight into it really balances them. They get It's kind of like David Lynch and his partner that wrote Twin Peaks, that I can't think of right now, but
I know who you're talking about.
Mark Frost
or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Frost was the one that kept the linear story, whereas David was the visionary. I think the Duffers are the same way. The Duffers are these visionaries, and Levy is the one that kind of grounds it in some solid storytelling. So they couldn't. They finally got Levy to produce it and said he would produce it, but they still didn't have a name for it because the original name was like a Montauk. It was a town. It was the same town that they shot Jaws in, and they thought that would be even cooler to actually call it that and everything else. But they ended up thinking, all of them thought they needed a different name. So for inspiration, they looked at old 80s paperbacks.
That makes sense.
And they saw Firestarter and loved the font. So they said, whatever we title it, that's going to be the font. So then they just started throwing titles into that font. And finally came up with Stranger Things, and they also don't agree with it. One of them really likes it and the other one doesn't, but that's what they went with.
That's a great story.
And they went with it because he said it reminded him of Needful Things, which was a Stephen King story.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I thought I talked forever to get there, but that was the basic
inspiration. No, I like that story. I had not heard that story. I do like the font. It looks very 80s. As far as the title, I can see why one of them doesn't like it because it is a little general,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas mm-hmm. it should be maybe more specific to the town or to the kids or whatever. It's just kind of mm-hmm. out there, which is, you know, I can live with it either way. I can see both sides.
It does kind of encompass the story, though, because it's not just the mind flayer. It's not just that. It's this combination of weird stuff that keeps happening, and they have to react to it. And also in the kind of weird 80s way, they're growing up, because it is like a coming-of-age story, and you get that kind of... I mean, Stranger Things could be, oh, I got a date with a girl, you know, yeah. kind of thing for these kids.
Well, and they didn't want to call it Stranger Indiana, because he had already right. done Wayward Pines, which was a little bit too similar to that as well.
Yeah,
there's your key for anyone that didn't know that. He also, the Duffer Brothers were also affiliated with Wayward Pines.
And who was the big producer on Wayward Pines? M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong. M. Night Shyamalan.
That's
and
right.
he was like their mentor for a while there. And obviously gave them all the good stuff, and he kept all the bad stuff for his later movies. But anyway,
I would say that's a great partnership, because I think they're very creative. I'm looking forward to seeing what else they do, because if you look on IMDb, they've not done a lot.
No, this has been like their focus. And
yeah,
if you look at behind this, if you look at like the little shorts or the behind the scenes or the whatever, I mean, the all the cast, the crew, everybody loves working with them. And almost everybody, I started to think, is this like a publicity ploy where they say you have to say this in any interview with all the crew? But everybody keeps mentioning how that every idea is valid to them. So even the third gaffer from the bottom can say, what about this idea? And their answer is always, the best idea wins, no matter what. So they're very collaborative. They're not like a Kubrick set or a Hitchcock set or one of those where, you know, this is precisely what I want. Like a Ridley Scott, you know, or something like that. Supposedly they're extraordinarily collaborative and very open to suggestions and ideas and thoughts, and they create a lot of stuff on set.
That's where a lot of the magic comes, because it's not
obviously
planned out. It's spontaneous. Yeah.
I think they did brilliant in casting. This group of kids and adults and everything works so well. I know the first year. So basically it's had three seasons. The first season was basically the whole story takes place around November. And that's the whole with the, they find out about this lab, they find out about the rift, and we get introduced to this character, 11, who was developed in the lab. We don't know how really, but she has these psychokinetic powers like Firestarter.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is a very King-esque element, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very. The whole 11 idea was, to me, was Firestarter.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole government project looking for her and that sort of thing. They basically have that storyline where Will is kidnapped by the upside down monster, and we don't know what it is, but an upside down presence or creature. And it's all about them trying to find him and rescue him. And with the help of Eleven, they finally do. And then in the midst of it, they have all these 80s adventures, whether it's the hunky guy from school is beating up on the nerds, but ends up getting beaten up himself or whatever. And then season two is basically Halloween. We show that the rift wasn't closed and Eleven did save Mike, but there's still monsters here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're growing underground.
And that Barb really is dead.
And that Barb is dead, by the way.
That was kind of a really cool, not sure what the, I guess you'd call it a pop culture moment there for a while, is that this really minor character named Barb became like an international sensation. Where is Barb?
Yeah,
what happened to Barb?
And that totally stunned them. All the people on production, the Duffers, everybody, they had no clue that it would be that way. They were like, what? Seriously? I mean, it was just a minor character that we got rid of, but so many people related to her and thought she was so believable.
I think it would be really cool if she came back now, like 4 seasons later, and they found her, you know. Oh my God, we found Barb. She's in the Upside Down.
She's been in the Upside Down for 4 years.
Yeah. She's got a little house down there.
Each season, although it's taking like a year and a half to do, is set in a year. So it's 83, 84, 85. So second season was Halloween, and we find out about the Mind Flayer. We also get introduced to new characters. Every season they're adding new characters, which, you know, that's a plus or a minus. It depends.
It's kind of a minus in my book, but we'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay. So they introduce, in season two, they introduce Maxine and her brother Billy, and then this Bob Newby guy, who is a boyfriend of Joyce's and works, but has a great job. He works at Radio Shack. Come on, in the 80s, working at Radio Shack, that was it, man. You had everything. Walkie-talkies and anyway, I remember my first computer ever, home computer, came from Radio Shack. It was a TS-800 or something like that, and you had to have a tape recorder. You know, you had to play the programs on a cassette tape in order to get the computer to work.
God,
anyway,
we're
so old, you whippersnapper kids out there. And then this season, of course, is Summer Vacation, which, you know, was really cool. And there's a strong hint in the very last episode that if they do a fourth season, which why wouldn't they if Netflix wants to?
Right.
That it may even be set at Christmas, because they keep talking about we're coming back at Christmas. So maybe that would be the setting for that one. We don't know, but we could speculate and see. What's your overall take on the series? I mean, do you think it works good from a horror and sci-fi perspective?
I do. I think it's a good marriage of both genres.
Mm-hmm.
And that's leaving
aside. I like the fact that they don't shirk on the scares.
The scares
are good.
And they don't shirk on the gross outs either. And, you know, Stephen King and Dance Macabre talked about the different kinds of either horror, terror, or you could go for the gross out. And they do all three really well.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from like the 80s references, just looking at it, I like the storyline of it being about a town and something not quite right about the town, but because of this connection with the Upside Down. It's not unlike other, if you're going to throw just a few keys out there, you've got Under the Dome by Stephen King, or even Castle Rock, and some of the stories set in Castle Rock. This just happens to be Hawkins, Indiana, where there's this, you know, strange thing going on with like evil government stuff, which is very X-Files if you want to go in that territory, as well as in the third season when we come to find out that now Russians got their fingers into it and they've got something going on with digging up what's there. And I also like the it's almost a Clive Barker-esque element that it's another dimension too. It's not it's so not it's necessarily under the ground. It's basically parallel to us, just another dimension.
Right. Right. I think you're right. And that's very Clive Barker, very Lovecraftian, all of that stuff, because they can create these crazy creatures that, you know, very cool designs of scare. Mm-hmm. Lots of teeth, nasty teeth.
Pointiness.
Yeah, I do think the strengths of the... what do you think are some of the strengths of this? You said setting in a small town.
Well, the strengths are definitely in casting. Even Winona mm-hmm. Ryder, who drives me insane now because she's just too manic, she's good in the first season as the devastated mother that's missing a child. Mm-hmm. I think, is his name David Harbour? Something Harbour. That plays...
Yeah, Harbour plays Hopper.
He plays Hopper, and I think he's well cast. The kids are awesome, especially the first season. So there's strength in the cast. there's strength in the production. I mean, I know we kind of dwelled on it, but it's very nostalgic because mm-hmm. we grew up with films like this, and they are paying homage to those films. So I would say it's second... key strength is nostalgia, for sure.
Yeah, and their storytelling, all of these Easter, we call them Easter eggs, but all of these homages, things they do, and it's not just in one style. It's not just visual. It's not just lines. It's not just characters or plotting. It's all of it. You know, I don't know if they binge watch every 80s movie ever made and go through it, but there's so many references.
Yeah, I was kind of curious as to their age because they seem younger than us, yet.
Oh, they are.
Okay.
They are.
Because, I mean, it's almost like something we would have done. And we're about 10 years older than them, probably, is what I'm guessing.
Yeah. And they grew up. It says that they were actually born in 84.
Wow.
Yeah. Much younger.
Than more than 10 years.
yeah. More than 10 years.
So they must have been watching these movies on video or DVD.
Yes.
Where we were watching them in the theaters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were actually watching them as they. And that's why I think. A, it says it's a strengths of theirs that they've hired directors of photography and cinematographers and everything that can preserve it, but also that they have such an eye for what they liked in these 80s movies.
Mm-hmm.
One simple thing, and it just blew me away because I'd been aware of it subliminally, I think, but they had an interview with the director of photography. And he said what he loves about the Duffers is they let him do they let him create this aesthetic of the 80s. He said a simple one, just for example, anytime we do interiors at night, we put blue lights outside all of the windows. You would never do that in a modern movie, but they did it in the 80s all the time. To show that it was nighttime, they would put a blue light outside the windows. He said, so we make sure we do that in everything. And I went, duh, that is so good. And because it's blue, it makes oranges deeper.
Mm-hmm.
So visually, that's why you get that kind of really vibrant orange patina that all the 80s movies had. Mm-hmm. You know, E.T. and the remake of The Blob and all of those. So I was going, okay, that makes perfect sense. That's really cool. Who's your favorite character?
Wow, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about it. Mm-hmm. I like Hopper a lot. As far as kids, I probably like now I'm at a loss for his name. The one that has the that's missing teeth.
Dustin. Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably my favorite kid, although it's been what I thought was a few years now and he still doesn't have any teeth.
Yeah, well, he actually has a condition.
Oh, he does?
When they talk about that condition, that actor literally has that.
Oh.
He has the missing bone late development kind of thing.
Okay.
And that's why, he doesn't have the teeth. And it's almost like a trademark now. From what I've heard through the grapevine or the fandom, you know, he could easily be, he's been approached by people saying, you know, we could fix your teeth. And he's like, nah. I kind of like it. It's kind of me.
Okay.
So, yeah, I have to say probably fandom-wise, too, he's probably the favorite and probably mine. And obviously the Duffers like him. They write for him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they... and I don't know if it's intentional, but, you know, in season two and season three, they separate him from the rest of the gang.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting because he seems like so integral to the gang, but they always keep separating him story-wise.
Here's where I could get critical.
Yeah, do it.
Now, I think that they're bringing on these other characters and people, you know, get popular and they want more screen time when they come back. So in order to justify it, they're splitting up the core characters with new characters to develop, you know, a larger plot with larger characters. And that kind of annoys me a little bit.
I agree. I think you're totally right. I think if we talked about, like, you know, strengths and weaknesses, so strengths are definitely their storytelling, the fact that they can have all these homages and they make them into, they're not like, oh, look, here we're throwing out this reference or whatever. It's just part of the world that they're in, which works, mm-hmm. Rather than calling attention to it. And I think that's brilliant. Casting is great. But weaknesses...
One of the strengths of the first season was that Hopper and Winona Ryder were not in it as much. They were necessary, mm-hmm. but they weren't integral to the plot, or at least not every episode. And
right, it was a kid's story.
Yeah, and this new series, they're in every episode, and they have their own little plot going, him in his Magnum P.I. shirt. You know, I'm like, you know, I mm-hmm. like them, but I don't like them that much. You know, quit, and I certainly don't want to see Winona freaking out every frame.
But although I do think she's much better in season three than she was in season one. Season one became almost like meme-worthy of how over the top she
yeah.
was hysterical.
Yeah. I agree.
Whereas in this one, she gets angry at times, but she's not overplaying the anger, in my opinion. I think she's doing a lot better with it.
Yeah.
Hopper actually is a lot grumpier in season three than the other two seasons.
That may be why I like it.
Yeah.
Because I'm grumpy too.
But I agree with you. I think weaknesses are, like in season two, a weakness was we had to have this whole, we want to try to develop Elle more, so we take her off on her own adventure in Chicago or wherever she went, where she found she had a sister and there are other people like her and all this. And we were like, what? And then we just totally forgot that plot by the end of the season. And this year, not mentioned it at all. As a matter of fact, and that's a weakness, I think, in this season, Elle comes off in this season being back like she was in season one, a little bit more... a little bit socially inept, even in the way she talks. You know, she repeats things from people because she was raised in a lab.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly at the end of season two, she was like Miss Super Hip, wearing her kind of, you know, goth jacket and her tennies and everything. You know, I was going, okay, but now so we've just kind of reverted her. And this year, I think the plot gets a little bit too expansive with these added characters. Because, you know, you not only had Will's mom is in it a lot more, and the
Hopper
mom and,
is too.
Yeah. And you added the mayor, and you added this Terminator Russian guy that's in almost every scene, and then you even added Dustin has a girlfriend, who, by the way, though, that moment in, I guess it's in the finale or in season seven or episode seven or episode eight, but. When they go into the never-ending story, I cracked up. And I love the fact that it was right in the middle of this huge moment in the plot with yeah. everything coming together, and they have to go into never-ending story. And what made this, I think what says a lot about Stranger Things is not only do they just do it, they don't cut it off and stop. They do the frickin' song.
Mm-hmm.
Almost to the point of it's almost too much. But then you start thinking... An 80s movie would do that. They would do that. You know, they would show the whole montage of, oh, yeah, and yeah. do the whole montage thing the whole time.
I love that
even
song.
Though it's not pushing the plot.
They used that song in two movies. They used that song in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and they used it in that Michael J. Fox movie about business. Big Business or something like that. No, it's not Big Business.
Yeah.
But anyway, they used that "Oh Yes" song in two movies the same year, I think. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I mean, we should probably get on and talk about what we actually are doing the podcast about. But we have digressed forever into Stranger Things.
80s nostalgia, it's the power, man.
I mean, because literally, we could go on. I know if we just started listing keys now, we could probably do another hour.
Definitely do a bunch in like a quick 5-minute roll. I guarantee it.
Well, okay. I'll give you just a few of mine just from season 3. So just from season 3, and you actually mentioned one of them, Magnum P.I., Phoebe Cates, Day of the Dead, which got me from the very beginning. I was going, Tim will love this.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Stand By Me, one of mine that I got immediately, and I don't know if a lot of people did, but hopefully some people did, was Hopper being stood up at the restaurant, getting drunk on red wine, and then as he's leaving, he says, I can do anything. I'm the chief of police, which is a direct line from Jaws when he got drunk on the red wine and went to cut the shark open. And I went, yes.
And that's not even the 80s. That's a good decade earlier, too.
Yeah. But that whole it reminded me so much of that Alien from the whole creature design sort of thing.
Well, and you've got some repeats, too. You've got kids on their bikes at night, which is totally E.T. You've got a smaller version of the Mind Flayer. Well, it grows bigger, and it's totally out of some kind of Lovecraftian thing, just like the second season. And then you've got this huge blob element from in the remake, particularly of the blob, which is a lot faster paced and a little more interesting. You've got, you know, it can melt and go through drains and come after you, you know, or under doors and stuff, which is really cool as well. And
I think they use the same coloring. I meant to go back and look, but I think they use the same coloring design for it when the creature's the blob as the remake. Because I seem to remember it like eating the sheriff in the phone booth or something in the blob. And it was like that kind of reddish, almost purpley kind of color.
Yeah, and you could see bones in it and stuff. It wasn't that Kevin Dillon and some guy named Russell directed it?
I think you're right.
I started to say Jack Russell. That's hilarious. Chuck Russell, I think, was his name.
Was it Matt Dillon?
No, I think it was Kevin, wasn't it? His brother.
Okay, it might have been. Yep. I think you're right.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but I do remember liking it.
Yeah, I liked it too. And there's tons more. I mean, we could just go on. I mean, you've got the Terminator. Because this Russian guy looks... I mean, they even have the same haircut, I think, as Terminator.
Well, you could go into non-genres as well, like Red Dawn and stuff like that. Remember that movie? Where... the teenagers were going up against the Russians on American soil or whatever it was.
Patrick Swayze, you know,
right.
Handling the kids. And that's a guilty pleasure of mine. I actually admit I like that movie as a Patrick Swayze movie. I would watch that before I'd watch Roadhouse.
I will admit that I have seen neither one of them.
Oh, man, you got to see Red Dawn. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
But you know, I knew about it. That's why I mentioned it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, but I mean, First Blood, Godfather, Terminator, even Christmas. I mean, National Lampoon's Vacation, because one of the code words is the Griswolds, which I liked too.
You had the trope of her. I can't think of the Wheeler girl's name. She's the secretary or the receptionist that's being abused by all the old men wanting coffee, all the old white men.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Welcome to America.
Well, and that trope was well played in the 80s, from low budget all the way to like Working Girl or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's all over the place back then.
Yeah, you had Something Wicked, you know, with the big Hall of Mirrors scene and everything else.
Oh, yeah, the carnival. Mm-hmm.
All the helicopters flying over reminded me a lot of Close Encounters. And then you had the whole We'll Meet Again song, which was Dr. Strangelove, even. I thought that was great.
I posted not long ago, or actually earlier this week, on Facebook a thing with locales that they shot in and around Atlanta for different seasons. But I have a closer key in that one of my neighbors, Jennifer Martin, is in the show. She plays the Graviton operator on episode 7. She
really?
Lives literally around the corner from me. She does our neighborhood's website, and Dennis has been on the board of directors twice, so he got to know her as well. She lives in our neighborhood. So look her
That's up. That's awesome.
Jennifer Martin.
Excellent. She's the one that wrote, that yelled at him like,
yeah,
sit
she's
down,
like, get up against the wall or something. Yeah.
Well, and it was, and you've got closer ties because it was filmed all over Atlanta, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
That's where they shot this whole season.
It was shot in Gwinnett Place Mall, which is a mall really close to me that has gone really downhill, has lost a lot of its anchors, and is virtually vacant except for a handful of stores. So I guess that made it easy for them to film there. But in the 80s, it was a thriving mall, and my husband, Dennis, worked there at a Bentley's Luggage in the 80s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was like, our store used to be near that food court. He was saying all this stuff while we were watching it. Yeah.
Well, so they recreated that brilliantly. Costuming, hair, makeup, all of that look of the mall was great. And I love the name of it, the whole Star Court.
It sounded like an arcade. Yeah.
Yeah, and sounded a lot like, you know, the whole homage back then of Star Wars and everything else. So that worked really cool. We both like Stranger Things. Go watch all 3 seasons. Enjoy it. Like I said, get your best athletic tube socks out and your ugly shorts. And if your female, tease up the hair, wear some blue eyeshadow. It'd be great.
I wear some bad shorts and those knee-high socks and have a bold
haircut.
Oh, my God. That was horrible haircuts. I felt so sorry for those kids. And I was like, God, tell me I didn't look like that.
Oh, please. Yeah, no. And all those, I mean, the worst ones, though, the worst shorts to me, though, were the conspiracy theory guy wearing his denim cut-off shorts. I went, oh, my God.
Yeah. And that weird curly mullet that the lifeguard dude has. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm at a loss for all the character names. I don't have it in front of me, but he was one of the bad guys.
No, no problem.
Yeah.
Oh, Billy.
Mm-hmm.
Billy, yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's Stranger Things. Go, you guys go out and watch it.
Yeah.